This is Angle of View. Today is June 9th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. If you're wondering how I feel about the two Gen Z horror movies that have taken the world by storm, Backrooms is good and Obsession is bad. I hope to have a little more than that to say about the two movies next week. It's past time for a new releases catch-up, and I'm almost there. But in the meantime, here are reviews of some Paul Thomas Anderson movies. Anderson has the distinction of having directed the movie that has taken me the most words to review on this show so far. I don't think that's particularly interesting either. What's more interesting is that the huge audience response to One Battle After Another was really only slightly bigger than his norm, by which I mean that he's one of the few American filmmakers with dedicated fans who turn out for every movie of his and sit around at bars discussing them. And compared to the other big contemporary with that kind of pull, Christopher Nolan, he's much more artist than engineer. I was going to wait until I could rewatch Boogie Nights before running him down, but not only did I not find time for that, but I also looked over my reviews of his other movies and found that I had more than a show's worth already, even without that early masterpiece. So I'll be sharing reviews of four of them today. I'll go in forward chronological order so that I can get away from Magnolia as quickly as possible. Magnolia, 1999, review date, June 16th, 2025, probably something like 16th viewing, which makes it the movie that I have seen the most, despite disliking it. Paul Thomas Anderson is a major talent who made too good a movie too early in his career, Boogie Nights, and got too much praise too young. Amid the hurricane of hype and celebrity that descended on him and the free rein he received at New Line in the aftermath, we are lucky that he limited himself to one gargantuan, undisciplined ego trip before coming back to Earth, stripping himself bare, and beginning his development as an artist in earnest. Magnolia throws everything but the kitchen sink at the screen, but has no center and no heft and no idea what it's doing. It's remarkable that the prologue so coolly lays out the contradiction on which the whole film will be impaled without even realizing that it is a contradiction. Ricky Jay's monologue recounts three news items, each a stunning coincidence, and then says, by way of conclusion, quote, "And it is, in the humble opinion of this narrator, that this is not just something that happened. This cannot be one of those things. This, please, cannot be that. And for what I would like to say, I can't. This was not just a matter of chance. Oh, these strange things happen all the time." The movie that follows tears itself in half trying to live up to this, to be amazing but not, making gestures of openness to character possibility and resonant smallness a la Altman, while also trying to impose an agenda which will force the characters into some great convergence that will deliver transcendent meaning. Then, when it must confront the fact that it's promised the impossible, it just puts the pedal to the metal and drops frogs from the sky. That crazy finale sort of puts some of the characters into partial convergence, suggesting that the point, after all, was not where everyone would end up, but what they would have learned along the way. But unfortunately, what they learned didn't amount to much more than a torrent of shouted rage and grief about bad fathers and GD regret. The softer speech in the movie is arguably worse, especially in the monologues, possessed of a studied brokenness that is maximally awkward, as when Jason Robard says, "Mistakes like this, you don't make. Sometimes you make some and okay, not okay, sometimes you make other ones." Or for that matter, "This please cannot be that, and for what I would like to say, I can't." None of the dozen or so characters is actually fleshed out. They've all got so little time to make themselves understood that they have to collapse their feelings down into proclamations and blast them out at 100 decibels. It's 3 hours long, but severely underbaked. Anderson has always been more of a director than a writer, and has always leaned on his actors to dig out the emotional essence of a scene instead of putting it in the words. This has worked to mixed effect in his career, but is often sold by his amazing instincts for casting, Cassandra Koulikoundis, and the effect is most certainly mixed here. Many of the performances are wonderful and fully inhabited despite the lack of writing support. Philip Seymour Hoffman, John C. Reilly, William H. Macy, Melinda Dillon. While others, Julianne Moore especially, to a lesser extent Melora Walters, also Tom Cruise kinda, just fall apart over and over again before your eyes. Coiling the film around Amy Mann songs, many of which are tender and beautiful, especially Save Me, could have been an ingenious strategy for justifying this choice to distill the characters down into grand statements and gestures. This is the kind of thing that musicals and operas are made for, and the movie is definitely at its best when the songs are up in the foreground. But Anderson doesn't push the musical conceptualization hard enough. Robert Elswit's lighting covers a whole spectrum of intensities and always stops your breath in your throat. In another kind of movie, this could have been the blanket that wrapped everything up. This gorgeous, warm view of the San Fernando Valley that holds and soothes everyone. But it's not a big enough blanket to cover this much. There ultimately is no binding concept of any kind at work, which is never more of a problem than in a movie which announces grand intentions and demands 3 hours of your time to fulfill them, constantly assuring you that it will have been worth it. When you finally get to the end, wondering what it was all supposed to mean, a 12-year-old boy informs you that this happens. This is something that happens. Oh, is that what that was? There Will Be Blood, 2007, from the novel Oil by Upton Sinclair. Review date August 20th, 2024. Sixth or seventh viewing. Fossil Fuel and the Church each take one of America's hands and dance it into the 20th century. Both institutions are represented by psychopaths. I have not read the Upton Sinclair novel that this is based on, though I can easily imagine it being a resonant object for a 2000s American filmmaker, especially a Californian one, asking himself how his country had gotten to be where it was. Compared to Sinclair's usual flavor, though, the film is immeasurably earthier. Despite the ripe setup, it does not at all come off like a big didactic socioeconomic allegory, and it's because Daniel Plainview is so magnificently developed, with an interior that is somehow vividly bottomless. Anderson loves to write tormented leads who can't express themselves verbally. This goes hand in hand with him being a director of such physicality. He likes to push his stories in other ways. And from the very start of There Will Be Blood, Daniel Day-Lewis stands out as the best actor that he ever put on this task. Plainview's words are always broken and jammed because he doesn't like talking any more than he has a gift for it. Even when he's passionately arguing, he spurts jumbled sentiments like, "Then the well can't produce and blow gold all over the place." But Day-Lewis puts all this lost articulation in Plainview's face and body language, so that his rage and hatred seem to be drawn up from a terrifying inner well of darkness and attended by a huge, monstrous past. And because of this, his eruptions of violence aren't surprising even when they're shocking. If he can't talk, his darkness needs alternative modes of release. The movie runs on Day-Lewis's bile and death stares, and these never cease to be enough. It really is one of the great movie performances, and a testament to him, at least as much as to Anderson, that so many of his line readings became best-of-the-decade movie moments. By interesting and not entirely cheerful contrast, Anderson does a decent job writing sharp, confident dialogue for Eli, one of his first major characters who actually did enjoy expressing himself verbally. But this performance by Paul Dano, who had never been a good actor, is, adjusted for size, the feeblest in any Anderson movie. Dano was 22 at the time. Eli, by the end of the story, is in his 30s, and at all times the character needs to be larger than life. Yet Dano never appears older than 14, about as imposing an antagonist as Finn from Adventure Time, and with just as squeaky a voice. Day-Lewis is unquestionably this oil man. Dano could never be a successful preacher. Along with a few clunky or ill-considered dialogue choices, one too many bastard from a baskets, the really dumbfounding pipeline, reminder line after the baptism, etc., Dano is the one nagging problem. It's as compelling a movie visually as has ever been made. The production design, Jack Fisk, and photography, Robert Elswit, are astonishing. Somehow able to support the action almost undetectably, putting the period and setting totally beyond question, while still being there to drink deeply of whenever you decide to turn your attention toward them. Much the same can be said of the sour-stomached terror that is Johnny Greenwood's score. With talents like these in the stable, and with Anderson knowing he can trust them, he relaxes into a new level of expressive power here as a director. Neither the hard-push Scorsese tendencies from his 90s films nor the woolly dreaminess of Punch-Drunk Love are in evidence anymore. He's cut his way down to the raw bone of a style and hit 1,000 nerves along the way. Everything is the more upsetting for the way the camera lies down on it. Almost all the movie's most hideous scenes make you yearn for a cut quite a bit before you get it. When Greenwood's music is absent, the feeling is so suffocatingly stark that you realize you've been missing it, and breathing sighs of relief when it's come back in. It's the rare modern movie whose dramatic excellence comes from its dealing in large emotions rather than small ones. It has the theatrical brio to sell them when they come forward, and the patience to shape them well over the long haul. Ultimately, what makes the film feel America-sized is not some ideological force or political passion on Anderson's part, nor a broadness of approach, but his recognition of and conviction in the dramatic maximalism that the story requires. The Master, 2012. Review date August 30th, 2024. Second viewing. During this pivotal and fascinating moment in his career, Anderson was searching for America's sickness. In both There Will Be Blood and The Master, he managed the best effort that an artist working in film can make in tackling a subject of that size, which is to sharpen a single perspective to such clarity that it fixes you totally and expands in your mind, so that as you take it in, you could be convinced that this single perspective could fairly be said to tell the whole story, even if you know for a certainty that there are more dimensions to it than that. There Will Be Blood conquered you with its view of American capitalism's predatory and acquisitive impulses as they underwent a major growth spurt in the early 20th century, and made it a story so lucid and grand that you could see all of the country's history over the ensuing 90 years as its runoff. His essential companion piece, The Master, does it by reminding you that the most valuable thing an enterprise can acquire is public devotion. The central huckster of The Master, Lancaster Dodd, Philip Seymour Hoffman, is a more advanced version of Eli from There Will Be Blood for the more advanced media age of 30 years later. Eli was forced into an adversarial relationship with the oil baron who controlled the local economy, because that was his only conceivable path to wealth. Dodd is not only smarter and more magnetic than Eli, but his media empire is an economy unto itself, at least if you factor in what he has gained by defrauding his donors. Therefore, he is both the tycoon and the demagogue, and so his counterpart must be the worshiper, the congregant, the poor man who takes his hot wind for wisdom, and that's Freddy, Joaquin Phoenix. The Master is, without exaggeration, the most beautiful color film ever photographed, in Panavision 65mm by Mihai Malamer Jr. The light is so enveloping and so texturally complete that the rooms and even the beaches feel like fabrics that you're being swaddled in. But it is, above all, and rapturously, an actor's movie, resting on two performances that register as a planet and its moon. As Freddy, Phoenix is the picture of unrest, a live wire, all the cords standing out at all times, chewing one side of his mouth even when he's laughing, so full of chemical rage and so lacking in his understanding of risk that he chooses violence even when it makes no sense at all, the effect of which makes him as unpredictable and terrifying as a bear. In Hoffman's Dodd, you see a man who, by contrast, almost never loses control, someone who appears to consciously choose his every facial expression, a creature of pure guile and performance. Hoffman demonstrates a control as keen as Phoenix's when he shows Freddy struggling under real feelings. Phoenix's Freddy can't wear a mask, and Hoffman's Dodd can't remove his. It would be a compelling pairing of characters even if Dodd did not also have an angry streak, which busts through the surface at critical times, namely when he perceives a threat to his dominion, which he does whenever anybody asks him any of the tough questions that might send the House of Cards crashing to the floor. But Dodd's communion with Freddy, in comprehending and even loving anger, doubles the poetry of their connection. That anger is Dodd's only honesty, so Freddy is bonded with him in the only real way possible. What they have with each other is probably the closest thing to love that either man has ever felt. It makes sense that a movie structured like this would make the contours of Freddy's damage fit the contours of Dodd's swindle, but what's brilliant about The Master is that this fit occurs not because Dodd's message resonates with Freddy, but because Freddy can't understand it, which to him is proof of its depth. Freddy is dull-witted and, partly in recognition of this, full of self-loathing. Therefore, he figures that any message worth a damn would be bound to pass over his head. He is a profoundly hard-edged man already three-quarters of the way to ruin in his 20s, boiling in hopeless shame because of his satyriasis and lost in substance abuse and violence as his coping mechanisms. Violence for Freddy isn't a matter of overreacting to provocation. It's a bodily need, and he simply can't hold it in, the same way he can't hold in his sexual impulses. You can set your watch by those valves in him blowing. When he goes to see his ex-girlfriend and is greeted by her mother and informed that she, the ex-girlfriend, has married somebody else and lives in Florida, you half expect him to seduce the mother or beat her to a pulp. This has made him unemployable and incapable of finding unpoisonous love. He only wants and only thinks he deserves the poisonous kind. Lots of people who know that they lack self-control join up with orders of one kind or another because they feel that they'd better entrust their steering wheel to someone else, someone smarter and more rooted, who will enforce boundaries and routines. Freddy, besides fitting this description, also hates himself so much that he is reassured by being made to feel small and stupid. So he responds to everything that he experiences in Dodd's orbit like a kicked dog, the same way he responded when he was a sailor. It's darkly amusing in light of this to hear Dodd address him as naughty boy or silly animal. And what does Dodd get out of Freddy in exchange for his love? Access to a limitless quantity of the paint thinner hooch that only Freddy is crazy enough to try to make. Or later the American cigarettes that Dodd misses after he moves to England. The two men are literally united by poison. It's a bleak union, as bleak as the place that sustains it. The Master is about a predator and a prey particular to this country. The quasi-religious, one-size-fits-all, free enterprise media guru, and the black and blue veteran, who having been spat out of one institution's mouth, can only be comfortable after finding another to crawl into. Inherent Vice, 2014, from the novel by Thomas Pynchon. Review date September 23rd, 2025. Second viewing. The main thing going on in Pynchon's novel is that the text itself is stoned, constructing itself in and as a spiraling haze, and you get that here. The way the story free associates, conjuring details into being as Sportello dreams them up and then fading them out when he stops, the way it all moves by drifting, including into danger, the way the melancholy at the crib death of the counterculture, how Sportello and his confreres know they're going to lose in all the ways that matter, ripples underneath the silly chaos and haunts all the relationships. That's all in the book, and the movie grabs the wavelength perfectly. But the movie is more of a pleasure to get caught up in than the book. The book is not completely shallow, but it is still light, a style exercise primarily, noir as a weed ash smudge, as opposed to the kind of drama that conquers you. And so it is right that a soft dreaminess should suffuse the movie, and that the bewilderment it offers up should be mostly a sanguine affair. Even when the air of defeat rushes up, it's like a celebration of what was, rather than an announcement of doom. Anderson is rewarded for his choices almost everywhere. With the ARPANET material excised, the story becomes less bleak. But that was the most crudely didactic stuff in there anyway, possibly the clearest case of the author writing that cultural epitaph on the story's surface and doing it in the blackest possible ink, as well as being some of the least cinematic. It's mostly typing, so it doesn't go down as much of a loss. The subtraction of the characters associated with that stuff and with the Vegas plot is also good for the sake of focus. We do go to Ojai, as that scene is too crucial to cut. But besides that, it's better as a movie if the locations are all more closely arranged, so that we feel that the place is somehow doing it, like we're trapped in a prankster god's magical playground. The way Bigfoot gets to share in the sadness instead of looming over it like a gargoyle is special and true to this warmer and more elegiac vision, and Josh Brolin gets in on this too. The scene of him housing Sportello's weed tray is a whole cloth PTA fabrication, and it is the perfect note to leave the movie versions of the two characters on. This is the best Bigfoot can do at making a connection, and it's an unhinged act that is still a show of force. And the way Anderson takes Soeur de Liege, who in the book is, like a lot of Pynchon characters, someone whose powers are plausibly deniable. It's an ambiguity built into her name, just as a coin toss is only divinely imbued if you decide it is, so she often sounds profound, but might simply be the one paranoid weirdo in the bunch whose specific trip is Lemuria, and makes her into the soothsayer and guardian angel of that place and everyone in it, is a really beautiful gesture, a warmer embrace of this poor doomed society than anything Pynchon had put in. Plus, it is masterful to cast Joanna Newsom as Hippie Dream Girl. And speaking of Hippie Dream Girls, Catherine Waterston is the most perfect floating California creature you could imagine. You get the woman and the myth in one. And the scene of Shasta's return, which is the best scene in the book, is fittingly the best scene in the movie, thrillingly heady for the mix of power and play that it brings to sex, the costume that Shasta is wearing when she is naked. As for Joaquin Phoenix, he muddies up some of his denser lines, often past the point of character appropriateness. Don't give the man lots of words to say. But everything he does with his face and body is gorgeous and sensitive. And his scream at seeing the baby picture is, I had forgotten, the funniest moment in any Paul Thomas Anderson movie ever. I had to pause at this time for a few minutes while I pulled myself together. It's a pretty wonderful movie, both lighter and heavier than it seems, by the same magic that makes Southern California the home of both surf music and Charles Manson. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.